I'm going to read this morning Exodus 24. Once more, this is God's holy, infallible, inerrant, and inspired word. And so let us give our attention to its reading. Then he said to Moses, "Come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near, and the people shall not come up with him." Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord, and all the rules. And all the people answered with one voice and said, "All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do." And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. He rose early in the morning and built an altar at the foot of the mountain and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men of the people of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half of the blood and put it in basins, and half of the blood he threw against the altar. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." And Moses took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. The Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandment which I have written for their instruction." So Moses rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up into the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, "Wait here for us until we return to you. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let him go to them." Then Moses went up on the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud and went up on the mountain. And Moses was on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of our God will stand forever. Beloved congregation of the Lord Jesus Christ, as we give our attention this morning to this book of Exodus, and particularly this moment in the history of Israel, I cannot help but reconvey the significance of this moment. Here, the people of Israel have assembled at Mount Sinai. Remember how they got to Mount Sinai. They got to Mount Sinai because they had been slaves in Egypt. And God had redeemed them out of the land of Egypt. How did he do it? He sent plagues against the Egyptians. He struck down the Egyptians. He struck at the very core of the Egyptians' religion, the gods they worshipped, the pantheon of gods that they worshipped. He struck them down one by one, showing that they had no authority, no power, that he is the Lord. And on that final night, when Israel was still in Egypt, God called them out and provided a way through that final plague. You remember the last plague, the 10th plague of striking down all the firstborn in Egypt. Anyone, any house that did not have blood on the doorpost of the lintels, that is the sides of the doors, any house that had not celebrated the Passover, that house was visited with death. Make no mistake, again, this strikes at the core of Egypt's religion. for they believed that the firstborn of Pharaoh was basically the new incarnation of their God. And here's the Lord striking down their God. And so Israel departs Egypt. They flee. They leave hastily with the blessings of the Egyptians, giving them silver and gold and clothing and so on. And they depart. And of course, you remember, they come to the Red Sea and God fights for them. We looked at this. We thought about this. I think it was just this last week, perhaps. It's been a long 2 weeks, so maybe it not. But God fights for them. He strikes down the Egyptians in the Red Sea as Israel marches through on dry ground. That's in chapter, and in chapter 15, they rejoice. They sing of God's wondrous deeds. For He has struck down the horse and the rider. It says, I will sing to the Lord, for He has triumphed gloriously. The horse and rider He has thrown into the sea. Israel marches through the wilderness as they come to Sinai in chapter 19. And there in chapter 19 and in verse 6, God reveals to Israel what they're doing there. You shall be to me my treasured possession, a kingdom of priests. And then the Ten Commandments come. And in speaking the Ten Commandments, God is laying out for Israel how they are. And Jesus explains this for us, doesn't He? In the New Testament, how they are to love God, to love the Lord their God with all their heart, mind, soul, and strength, and how they are to love their neighbor as themselves. The Ten Commandments, it's a summary of everything that Israel is to do and to be there within the land, how they are to relate to God and how they are to relate to one another. Well, there are many other laws that are given from chapters 20 onward, sort of explaining and not so much expanding, but talking about the application of those Ten Commandments. And then in chapter 24, God is ready to appear to Israel once more, to enter into this covenant agreement with them. And in so doing, God condescends. He condescends so they can see Him visibly. And there at the top of the mountain, what do they see? They see fire. Fire consuming the mountain. If you've ever wondered why in Exodus 32, they think, and maybe possibly, that Moses is dead, it's because he goes up into that cloud, into the presence of the fire. Well, that's the background of what's going on. God has called His people out, but they are not to remain at Sinai. They are to move on from there and to move to the Promised Land. And the Promised Land, you remember, this takes us back to the various studies that we've talked about, but the Promised Land stood for something else. Remember what Hebrews chapter 4 said, and I was struck by how well Hebrews 4 pairs with Exodus 24. God in His providence brings these chapters together for us today. But we think about everything that the Promised Land stood for. It could not have been final rest. He says if Joshua had given them rest, He would not have spoken of another rest later. The Promised Land pointed forward to something greater. It pointed forward to the new creation. We know this because the Promised Land is spoken of throughout the Old Testament in Eden-like terms, in ways that bring to mind Adam and Eve in the garden before sin entered into the land. There's a connection between that land and Eden. There's a connection between Israel and Adam, even as there's a connection between that land and glory, the new creation, and Israel and Christ. This is why when the New Testament, when it reflects upon the Promised Land, it tells us that the patriarchs were really longing for the world to come. Even while they were in the land, Israel dwelt as sojourners, waiting for the new creation. I think this helps us to understand a couple of things before we look closer at our text this morning. First, it helps us to understand the way that the Old Testament prophets spoke about how the restoration was to come. Everything was put into the language that was understandable to the people of Israel. This would have been language about the promised land, about life, health, abundant food. But it also helps us to understand that the promised land was never the end goal. Just as Adam and Eve would not have remained in Eden had they passed their probationary period, so Israel's march into the promised land was supposed to point them to the promise of recreation. We read in the book of Revelation that all the promises made to God come to pass in that new creation. Sin, sickness, and death are done away with. Well, let's consider our passage this morning together. As I said, there's something significant going on here in this text. It's something we've considered before. The Ten Commandments, our confession talks about the three uses of the law. It talks about the use of driving, revealing sin, driving us to Christ. The second use of restraining sin in the world around us. And the third use is for the believer as a pattern for sanctification. The law is not to be thought of as outdated and no longer of use to us as believers. But God has given it to us and given to us His Spirit so that we are able even to obey it, even if we do so imperfectly. But I want to say that what's going on here with Israel is something somewhat different. A covenant is being confirmed. A covenant is being ratified. And so this is a very fixed moment in redemptive history. This is why I believe that this passage must point us on to Christ. If we look at Israel and say, okay, they vowed to do everything before the Lord, and they failed. It's our turn. Let's insert ourselves into Exodus 24, minus throwing blood back and forth. Let's insert ourselves into Exodus 24 and see how we do. We're going to fail also. We're not the ones that get inserted here. It's Christ. It's Christ. Remember Galatians 4, we heard it in our assurance of forgiveness today, that He was born under the law. This is what Christ came under. And He came under it for our sake, for our salvation. The people of Israel are entering into a binding covenant with God as their king, as their lawgiver. And this covenant includes for them a clear call to obedience. And because of this, they must be careful to do what has been put forth. This is how they will come into the promised land. God will lead them there. Those who disobey and who outwardly disobey, obstinately disobey, will be cut off from the covenant. But also, once they get into the land, they're told they must continue to be obedient, or they will be removed from the land. You might be wondering, just as a pre-question, why we, within the Reformed tradition, look at a chapter like this, or any other chapter under the Mosaic covenant, and see God's grace. This is something that God's people have wrestled with for a long time. And for my own position and how I preach, I want to avoid both extremes. On the one hand, I want to avoid the extreme that says everything happening here is all grace, nothing but grace. Because I don't think that squares with the passage. I don't think that squares with the history of Israel and how they're ultimately removed from the land. But we want to avoid the other extreme. There is no grace. Surely, the animal sacrifices, foreshadowing, foresignifying Christ, show us God's grace in the Mosaic covenant. Surely the fact that God did not merely consume the top of the mountain with fire, or only consume the top of the mountain with fire, rather than rippling down and consuming Moses and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, the 70 elders and the entire people of Israel in judgment because they were sinners. Surely that reminds us that there is grace. The chapter before us falls into three sections. First, we see the meeting that is commanded by God. Then we see the covenant that is cut between the people and God. That's an important word, and we're going to talk about that. And lastly, we read about the meal with the people seeing God, beholding God. We don't want to rush over any of these parts. They're all significant in the establishment of this covenant at Sinai and where they will go when they depart Sinai. But they're also significant because the New Testament will pick up on all of them to speak of Christ and our salvation in Jesus. Let's look at this together. And first, the meeting commanded. The meeting commanded the people of Israel, being brought out of Egypt by way of the Exodus, having crossed the Red Sea on dry ground, as I've already laid out for us, at the foot of the mountain, are called by God to assemble once more. And it's something different. Remember, they're already there. They've already probably set up their tents. They're already camping around this mountain. And so this call is a call to something special, something different, a significant moment. You see, Israel is going to respond to God. It's no longer going to be Moses going up the mountain. There are going to be witnesses to what is going to take place. So we see here in the opening of the chapter, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. Moses alone shall come near to the Lord, but the others shall not come near. The people shall not come up with him. Just to underscore, I know I keep trying to say that this is a significant moment. Remember when they come to Sinai, what God tells them? Don't come near the mountain. Don't touch it. Anything, anyone that touches it will be put to death. And then God says, well, Moses and the 73 others, come on up. This is a significant moment and surely a fearful one for the people. Remember, they were afraid of what they've seen and what they have heard. God thundered from the top of Mount Sinai, and the people did not want God to speak to them. And they declared that Moses would be the one to speak in their behalf. And so God calls up these representatives. There are surely more than 70 elders among Israel, particularly given the number that we are told of in Exodus chapter 12 of 600,000 men coming out along with women and children and the mixed multitude that's coming out of Egypt. But these 70 would represent the people as they would go into the presence of God. And not just the 70, but Moses, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu. Remember, Aaron's going to be the first high priest. Nadab and Abihu, those sons of Aaron that are consumed by fire in God's presence in Leviticus chapter 10, which, remember, is happening right at the foot of Mount Sinai as they construct the tabernacle. But here we see they are set apart to come into God's presence. But notice there's a distinction to be made between how far the 70, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu were to go and how far Moses would go. They were to worship from afar, but still on the mountain. And Moses would be called to go up further. Even here in the midst of making a covenant with the people, we see the holiness of God as He continues to work through a mediator. But also notice what this does to Sinai. There's an outer area. Perhaps we could call it an outer court. And there, everyone is able to go. They're able to worship the Lord. That's the people upon the ground away from Mount Sinai. And there is a holy place where only designated individuals may go. The 70 elders, Nadab, Abihu, and Aaron. And then there is a most holy place where only one may go in behalf of all the people. What's going on here, beloved, is that Sinai is becoming a temple to the Lord. And they are worshiping God in His temple. That's what we see happening here. This is what will be replicated over and over again in the tabernacle and in the temple itself. And after the meeting is commanded, Moses proceeds to make the covenant between God and the people. And the very fact that Moses is doing this is a reminder of his position. We know throughout the history of Israel, there are three offices that are instituted: the prophet, the priest, and the king. The king, the one who rules and defends and leads the people. Moses has already sort of taken that responsibility, not upon himself, but God has given it to him. He has led them out of Egypt. He has defended the people before Pharaoh in his very presence. But he's also the prophet. And we can say he's the consummate Old Testament prophet. That's why, by the way, the book of Hebrews talks about Christ in comparison to Moses. Moses, the first five books of the Bible attributed to him. It is through Moses that God has led and revealed his word to Israel. And then we see that we also see in the Old Testament that there's that office of a priest. And here we see Moses really, in a sense, fulfilling all three functions, all three offices. It's why Moses is such a clear type of the Messiah who is to come. Well, verse 3 begins with Moses coming to the people and telling them all the words of the Lord and all the rules. I take it here that what Moses is doing is telling them about what's going to take place. That he's going to go up and the 70 elders and Nadab and Abihu and Aaron are going to go up. I take it that that's what's going on here. That they are to stay at the foot of the mountain. And what do they say? All the words of the Lord. All the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do. People of Israel understand what is going on here. God is their king. They are coming before him. They are entering into a covenant with him. And so then Moses begins this official ceremony. They must make their vow before God. It must be sealed in blood. And blood was required because it was a symbol of life. And entering into a binding covenant like this meant that Israel was vowing obedience upon pain of death. When God forbids Israel from eating an animal with blood in it, he says that it is because the life is in the blood. And this whole episode harkens back to Genesis 15, where Abraham enters into a covenant with the Lord by cutting in half the animals. And walking, well, Abraham was supposed to walk with God between them. But Abraham doesn't walk. God comes and walks with himself between those animals, taking the curses of the covenant upon himself. But here Israel vows obedience to the Lord. And not just part of Israel. We don't want to think that this is just those 70 elders making the decisions for everybody else. They are all assembled there at Mount Sinai. Moses builds an altar at the foot of the mountain and has 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. This was to be a national covenant, one that bound every tribe, every generation, every Israelite in the Old Testament. Two kinds of offerings were given. You probably noticed we've studied the book of Leviticus together last summer, and so we're familiar with the differences in these offerings. One was the burnt offering, the other was the peace offering. The burnt offering, most likely, at least the way it's given in Leviticus, is a sin offering. And it shows that sin demanded the judgment of God that was signified not just by some fire, but by the complete consumption of the sacrifice by fire. The peace offering, however, was not completely consumed by fire. Part of it would be prepared and eaten by the people in order to signify the peace that they have with God. All of the sacrifices would be drained of their blood according to the instructions that God would give. And in verse 6, we read that Moses threw half the blood against the altar. Now, this is not the bronze altar. It may have been bronze, but it was not the altar that will later be built and placed inside of the tabernacle and the temple. But it is made for this moment and continues to remind us of a temple-like setting. After all, the altar is in the outer court, if you will. It's among the people in the common area. Now, depending on your translation, it might say that he sprinkled the blood as opposed to throwing it against the altar. Both words are acceptable translations, and both speak to the fact that every part of the altar was to be touched by blood. Then came the moment of the official ratification of this covenant in verse 7. Then he took the book of the covenant and read it in the hearing of the people. And they said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do, and we will be obedient." Now, they've already vowed that they will do what God has said. I think that has to do with the preparations for this moment. But here they add, "We will be obedient." They have heard the Ten Commandments once more. They have heard all the laws that went along with it in chapters 21, 22, and 23. And they say, "We will be obedient." This is a religious vow binding the people to God according to these words. And then Moses makes it official. Verse 8 says that he took the blood and threw it on the people and said, "Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all these words." Now, if later scripture is any indication of how this would have gone down, chances are he was not heaving the buckets of blood into the audience, but rather taking a hyssop branch and sprinkling the people with the blood. God makes a covenant with his people, signified in the blood. Now, the word that is used here to speak of making this covenant is again this word, and I've already referenced it, that means literally to cut. To cut a covenant. God cut a covenant with his people that day. It's the exact same language used, as I said already, with regard to Genesis chapter 15, where God cuts the covenant with Abraham, promising to bring him and his numerous descendants into the land. But in the covenant with Abraham, as I said, God himself walks through the cut animals, guaranteeing its success. But in this covenant with Israel, the people vow their obedience. This is why theologians such as Gerhardus Voss and Charles Hodge see this as a legal type of covenant that is laid over the Abrahamic covenant. It is, as Voss says, law in service to grace. And it's sealed by the blood being placed upon the people. As I said, this is one of the defining moments in the history of Israel. What happens after this? The people see God. This is another indication of the significance of this redemptive moment. The people gathered there at the foot of Mount Sinai could hear the voice of God and see the theophany, the appearance of God in fire and flashes of lightning. But they could not see God. But look with me at verse 9. Beginning in verse 9. "Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel went up, and they saw the God of Israel. There was under his feet, as it were, a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness." However we want to wrestle with these words, and there's a lot of wrestling, there's a lot of commentators who go back and forth as to what exactly do they see, what is going on. The reality is that when they look up from where they are, they see God. What does that mean? Some believe that they're looking up and they're so seeing the image from underneath, which is why we read of the pavement upon which God is standing. Others believe that they did in fact see God, as it were, almost face to face, but were unwilling to give a description in order to protect against the breaking of the second commandment. Whatever the case, the description given matches the vision in Ezekiel as well as what is seen by the Apostle John in the book of Revelation. You see, this is the people beholding the Lord. Now, I tend to believe that what they're seeing here is a reflection of God's glory, perhaps a reflection through that sort of pavement that was like glass. And I think this in part because when Moses asks to see God later in Exodus, he will not be allowed to do this. He cannot look upon God's glory and live, look upon his face. We'll only be allowed to see his glory as it passes by. And God says to Moses at that time that no one can look upon him and live. But look at verse 11. I think this is just as significant as they're seeing God. and he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. There they were, in the presence of God, after the Lord himself had warned that the people should not even touch the mountain. And he did not lay his hand on them. Moreover, they communed with God. They beheld God. They ate and drank. And I think what we see here is the outcome of the peace offerings that were offered up. They took the food with them, those peace offerings, to go and to eat in the presence of God, signifying the peace they have with God. The covenant has been ratified, but will God accept them? And they're eating and drinking in the presence of God, and him not laying a hand on the chief people shows that God accepts them. Eating and drinking with someone signified fellowship, and therefore they're eating in God's presence. Indeed, beholding God himself is the final sealing of the covenant. That is S-E-A-L, sealing of the covenant. It shows that they were in covenant with the Lord, but the people stood back. They worshipped God from afar. And then the 70 elders, and Aaron and Nadab and Abihu, stayed where they were and worshipped God. And Moses drew near to God, the only one able to go near that fiery presence of God at the very top of the mountain, called up for 40 days and 40 nights. Everything that goes on there at Mount Sinai is significant as it's picked up in the New Testament. Perhaps some of it just picked up by way of comparison or contrast. We think of Jesus in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. There, battling temptation with Satan. Here, Moses in the presence of God, receiving the very law of God. What does Jesus do after he comes out of the wilderness in Matthew chapter 4? In Matthew chapter 5, he goes on to give the law of God. I think there's a connection here. But maybe if we stepped even further back from this mountain, we can discern something, I think, before we look at how it directly points us to Christ. I think we can see something very significant. This is something that, as I said, when I was in the Reformed worship class, we spent some time looking at this. This is a worship service. That's why it's significant that it's a temple. It's a worship service. We have every part of worship here. We have the call to worship. We have them dealing with their sin, offering up the burnt offerings. We have the word being given, the confession of faith, their vow of what they will do, the sacraments. That is, they go and they, having passed through the waters of Egypt, of the Exodus, which is a picture of baptism in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, they then come to a meal and eat in God's presence, pointing, of course, to the supper that we partake. And this has to be the case, because even the language that Moses uses here will actually be used by Jesus. In fact, there's only one other place in the entire Bible that we hear the blood of the covenant. It's when Jesus institutes the new covenant in his blood. In the Gospel of Luke, this cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood. Here Jesus is bringing together this moment at Sinai and everything that Moses pointed toward with the words of Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 31 to 32. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day when I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, my covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord." The Lord's Supper is just as significant of a moment as we find happening in Exodus chapter 24, perhaps even more significant since it is the fulfillment of all the promises of God. Jeremiah promised a new and a better covenant than the one that was made with Moses and the people of Israel. But even this new covenant would have one thing in common with the old, at least one thing in common, instituted by blood. like the burnt offering in our text, Christ would be consumed by the wrath of His Father upon the cross. And like the peace offering, His flesh and His blood would signify the peace that we have with God. He is the living bread that came down from heaven, He says in John chapter 6 and verse 51. And He follows up in verse 53 and says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink His blood, you have no life in you." This is why we say each week that we spiritually partake of the body and blood of Christ in the Lord's Supper. But this reminds us immediately of how the old covenant is different from the new, and how the new is so much better. Here, in our text, Israel commits full obedience, but they will fail. They entered into the covenant with their God, knowing that their obedience was essential, that their disobedience would bring them death and exile, which it does. But in the new covenant, Christ, our mediator, is our mediator, but He's also the one who obeys the law of God in our behalf. The book of the covenant. We don't, as I said already, we don't insert ourselves in here and say, "We are Israel." Jesus is Israel. This is the only way that we can be counted righteous in God's sight. For if the covenant is based in any way upon our obedience, even just a little bit, then we, like Israel before us, would never be able to stay in the promised land of the new creation. But even as we partake of the Lord's Supper each week and gather for worship, we see yet another difference between the old covenant and the new. And I think this one's, and they're all significant, but this one I think is very special. Moses was the only one permitted to go to the top of the mountain. Only 70 of the elders, with Nadab and Abihu and Aaron, were permitted to behold God and to eat and drink in His presence. But beloved, Jesus is the mediator of and the guarantor of a better covenant. Even now, those who trust in Christ are seated with Him in heavenly places, Ephesians 2 and verse 6. As we gather for worship, we do so not at Mount Sinai, but on Mount Zion. Moreover, He has promised to return and to take all His people to dwell forever in the presence of God. And as we partake of the Lord's Supper each week, we do so not alone, and not even just us, but in the presence of our God. Remember what the author of Hebrews says in Hebrews chapter 4. "Since we have confidence to enter the holy places by the blood of Jesus, by the new and living way that He opened for us through the curtain, that is, through His flesh. And since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near." Only Moses could draw near. Let us draw near with a true heart and full assurance of faith, with our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold fast the confession of our hope without wavering, for He who promised is faithful. As important as Exodus 24 is in redemptive history, it only finds its fulfillment and its ultimate significance in the new covenant instituted by the blood of Jesus Christ. And so as we reflect upon this chapter, we are reminded of what Christ has done in fulfilling the covenant obligations in our place, so that one day, what we know by faith, what we have already by faith, will be ours by sight. We know that we gather in the presence of God. We know that we behold God and eat and drink. Revelation 22, verses 3 and 4 says, speaking of the new creation, "No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and His servants will worship Him. They will see His face, and His name will be on their foreheads." Let's pray. Our good and gracious Father,